You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 473 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. This is Seth Miller hosting this week, joined by the ever-entertaining Mr. Fosma Moon. Fos, how you doing?
I am well. How are you doing?
Not too shabby. Stephen is off this week, taking some much-needed celebratory time, and as a result, the inmates are running the asylum once again. Always a good turn.
Yeah, no adults tonight.
American Airlines is going to take 260 new single-aisle planes.
It's not a lot of planes.
It is. It's arguably smaller, I feel like, than some of United's big orders, but it's a big one. And that, there's also, that's firm orders. There's also another 140 or so options. Interestingly, Embraer gets the biggest number of aircraft on the firm order.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
So the deal is 90 E-175s, and this is the first, you know, old Embraer E-Jet, I say old because it's been around since 2005, will be getting delivered into the next decade. They can't do the E-2s because even though they have the more efficient engines, they are also heavier, and they are not scope clause compliant, so the pilot union says they have to be flown as, or the agreement between the airline and the pilot union says they have to be flown as mainline, and America ain't going to pay for that. So here we go.
Does it have more seats than 175?
No, it's the same seating layout. It's if I remember correctly, it's the same seat layout. The problem is the total weight.
Interesting.
Part of that comes from the new engines, which are heavier but more efficient. Part of that comes from some other design stuff. I guess it's a good question, though, about the seating, because the 190 E2 and the 195 E2 actually are slightly bigger than their first-gen cousins, if I remember correctly, like one or two more rows of seats. But I believe the 175 E2, which doesn't really exist, it was like designed and spec'd and all sorts of other things, but they never built it because they're not going to do it if it can't happen in North America.
Right, because when US Air had 190s, they were part of mainline.
Right.
So,
yeah, I'm just pulling up the 175E2 details. Okay, so it was supposed to be 24 inches longer, one additional row of seats, which theoretically makes it a 90-seater in an all-economy condensed version. And they do have a prototype of it that has flown for 2 hours, but it's not happening anytime soon.
But so do we know for sure it's because of a weight issue and not a seat issue?
Scope clause agreements between mainline carriers and their pilots prevent these airlines from contracting with regional airlines due to aircraft operating with a maximum takeoff weight exceeding 86,000 pounds, and the E-175E2 is 12,000 pounds over that due to its heavier GTF engines.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Per Wikipedia, which cites Flight Global, so let's go ahead and say it's probably accurate.
Okay. Kudos to the union for thinking about airplane weight, not just seat count.
Yeah. So that's an interesting one. I'm actually still waiting to hear, and I would like to believe that American didn't announce this without thinking about it, but speaking of scope clause issues, often there is a rule about how many regional jets are allowed, and particularly how many 70-seaters versus 50-seaters.
Mm-hmm.
You may recall from some years ago now, probably 5 years ago now, United created the CRJ-550 because it accidentally had too many 70-seaters.
Yes.
And they took a bunch of the CRJ-700s, converted them to 50-seaters and said, no, these don't qualify as 70-seaters anymore. We can have as many of them as we want, because United's rule had a hard cap on the number of 70-seaters, but not the number of 50-seaters.
Right.
I have reached out to the American Airlines Pilots Union trying to get an answer on if these qualify and how it works. They have not responded yet, but a 2020 story about it suggested that they could only have 40% of their total mainline single aisle tails as 70-seaters.
Okay.
And then another like 30% or 35% is 50-seaters. But if the 50-seaters all go away, are they allowed to have more 70-seaters or not? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm trying to figure it out. But that was something that I thought was interesting and a weird potential sort of twist in the whole situation.
It's fascinating how these contracts work.
So those planes will be delivered sort of 12 to 18 a year over the next 6 or 8 years till we get through all of them. And American has said they expect that by the end of the decade, they will no longer have 50-seaters in their fleet. So that's some positive news.
It is, but I mean, I almost wonder if this is the the prop dance, as they like to call it, where they get rid of, you know, they said, like, how many times have the airlines gotten rid of all their prop planes to go all jet, only to bring prop planes back, go in and do it?
Yeah, fair. Absolutely. But, you know, we can operate the Q400 on runway 1129 at Newark and get work around all the congestion issues in Newark, and it'll be no big deal. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that worked out really well.
Yeah, for those who don't recall, that was Continental's position, what did I say, 15 years ago or so?
Yep. Yeah, that's probably about right.
It did not go as planned, to say the least. But that was the theory at one point. I agree. It is nice to see that they're pushing towards an all-two-class or two-cabin seating environment. All the planes will have Wi-Fi on board, and their new Wi-Fi is coming soon, satellite-based, fast, actually, Wi-Fi. Those installs are starting, I think, later this year on the existing fleet. But by the time that happens, when these planes are delivered, they should have the new stuff, you know, fresh and whatnot. So that's all. I think that's relatively good news. One other thing is, American has said they're not going to need to pull out of smaller markets. They'll still be able to serve them even using the bigger planes. And that was sort of always one of the reasons to keep 50-seaters around, is you needed them for the smaller markets. And apparently that's no longer the case.
Well, I guess the question is, will they be reducing frequencies?
One would presume in certain scenarios, yes. They also, by the time this all actually happens 5 years from now, there's probably a theory that the small markets will be big enough. Right, there's going to be continued growth in the U.S. market, even though it's already very large. So maybe it won't matter. Like the 50-seaters, they'll need the 75 seats at that point, or 70 seats, whatever it is.
I mean, that's kind of wishful thinking, because I would imagine that a lot of these places with the 50-seaters are not, their populations aren't really booming.
Probably not. But that's what they published. That's what they said. We'll see.
Okay.
So that's one of the three. All three single aisle manufacturers got a win out of this deal, which is pretty interesting. Next up.
Well, let's see if Boeing actually got a win. They have to deliver something.
Yeah, details. They won an order. That's all I'm saying.
Go for it.
I was going to say, we got Airbus first. So Airbus gets 85 A321neos out of the deal. Notably, the order does not specify LRs or XLRs. It just says neos. And right. I would expect that they actually would take the base model on these, because they just want them for domestic stuff.
I mean, they have a crap load of 321s already.
Right. But the goal is to continue to upgauge and continue to grow operations in constrained airports. So I don't think they want long range out of this. This is, you know, replacing old 738s and other things. So just bigger planes, you know, single aisle bigger, but generally normal operations. Domestic stuff. What was real interesting about this to me, though, was looking at the delivery schedule. They're actually delaying some deliveries in the 2025 and 2026 timeframe.
Okay.
Out to 2027 and beyond. So, and in the release, they mentioned there's, quote, smoothing, end quote, the delivery timeline, which in this case, once again, means delaying. So financially, also probably good for American to have a little lower CapEx for the next couple of years on new airplanes.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realize this. They have 302 738.
Yeah, it's a big fleet.
And 217 321 classics.
Yeah. So what was also interesting, though, is they said they're not going to be retiring any single aisle planes immediately as part of this order. Now, we'll see how much that actually holds true. But
immediately, like, some of these planes aren't coming for 8-9 years.
Right. So it's entirely possible some of them do end up becoming replacements, but right now, at least, there's mostly the talk is about fleet growth. So again, TBD how real that is, but that's part of the conversation. And what I also thought was interesting is Airbus has previously said they're basically sold out through the end of the decade. So they managed to scrounge up some delivery slots later in the in the later years of the decade for American. Now, American had to give some up a couple of years prior, and so, you know, maybe there's just some shifting at that level. But United had also been rumored to be looking for delivery slots in the next 2 to 4 years.
Right.
So, and, you know, there's discussion whether maybe some of the ones that Spirit and JetBlue, who would each both deferred some new deliveries over the next few years, might get repurposed, and how that might play out. unclear how Americans' order here might impact that and how many United was really looking for. But there does seem to be at least some slots available if you push and pull in the right ways and have, you know, the right type of demands and checkbook available.
Yeah, money talks.
Yeah. So that's the Airbus order. Also relative to Airbus, the 319s and 320s are getting an upgrade.
And more first class seats.
Yeah, it's the Oasis product, so maybe not the best first class seats, but 319s go from 8 to 12, 320s go from 12 to 16, so an extra row in both. New overhead bins, lighting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Fancy stuff inside. Power ports, power outlets at every seat. That's actually a big one for me.
That's good.
I'm old enough to remember when US Airways had power on those original 319s and 320s, and then Doug Parker took over and took them all out.
Oh, God, yeah, I remember that.
They were the 12-volt. It wasn't the cigarette adapter, though, right? It was the M-Power, the original M-Power port, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, the 20-volt or whatever it was.
Yeah, 12-volt, but it was like a funky plug. Yeah, I got my office to buy me one, like, and when I was commuting to D.C. in, I mean, the early 2000s. So I could leave my laptop plugged in on the 40-minute flight on the U.S. shuttle.
I had forgotten about the M-Power plugs. Thank you very much.
Yeah. We're old, Foz. It's a good time. And then Boeing, as you noted, also gets some orders. 85 MAX 10s. The plane that doesn't quite exist yet.
I mean, is it really an order if it's vaporware?
The theory is, so again, similar to the 321s, this order shifts a bunch of expected deliveries later in the timeline. Part of that is that 30 existing MAX 8 orders are going to be converted to MAX 10s, and then an additional 85, so it'll be 115 total. Those are expected to start arriving at the earliest in 2028. And so the theory here, best I could figure, is, well, in 4 years, Boeing better have it shit together and figure out how to deliver these airplanes. And if not, American could switch them back to MAX 8s or MAX 9s. But also, like, if Boeing hasn't figured out how to deliver the MAX 10 in 4 years, there's much bigger problems to deal with, I feel like.
Well, they're also, Boeing's also being forced to redesign the anti-ice system or something.
Right?
They had a waiver, but they're not getting the waiver anymore. Now they're being forced to redesign it, I thought I was reading.
Yes. And so they always were going to be forced to redesign it. The difference is now that neither the MAX 7 nor the MAX 10 can be delivered with a waiver prior to that redesign.
Add one more thing to the list.
And the latest report I've seen, John Ostra over at AirCurrent suggested that that's a 9 to 18 month program right now. So that puts certification in, I mean, if they get it in 9 months, maybe you get certification sometime mid to late 2025, but much more likely seems like 2026 now for the 7 and the 10.
Yeah. And, you know, at the same time, they sell this 777X going on.
Yeah.
They have a lot of balls in the air right now.
Yeah. And, oh, by the way, the 787 has an engine anti-icing thing also going on.
All the engines are Rolls-Royce engines, like history has always prevailed.
I don't remember, to be honest, but I did see something about that come across the other day. So, good times. Good times. I'm trying to think what else happened on that one. I think that's more or less it on the American order. So, a lot going on there, but
pretty big news for them.
Yeah. I mean, listen, again, all the airlines these days seem to be putting out these mega orders relative to their size and existing fleets. Part of that is airlines are bigger now and are ordering relative to their existing fleets. Part of it is, as alluded to before, like manufacturers are running out of planes or delivery slots. And so if you want to get a plane, you got to get in now, even if the plane's not going to show up for 8 or 9 years.
But a lot can change in 8 or 9 years.
Yes.
Crazy.
And so that's why a lot of these are, we have an order and it's a firm order and whatever, but the order includes the right to, you know, if not necessarily change our mind, you know, change which model within the family. If a new family gets ordered, you know, there has never been a time where a manufacturer that I know of that has said, oh, yeah, we know you ordered last generation plane, but now we've got a new one. We're going to make you take the old one, right? As long as they get 2 or 3 years advance warning, it's very easy to shift things around.
Right.
If it's when it's less than that, because that's around when, how long they give lead times to suppliers, you know, it's seating or interiors or even, you know, wings and fuselage and stuff like that. That stuff gets set a couple of years out. And so And then, you know, Airbus or Boeing just does the final assembly. Or
right, because it's not just the final assembly of the plane, right? There's all the other things, engine, to your point, the interior components. And while it's easier to probably ramp up a factory and make seats, something like an engine, that's not exactly easy to spin up additional capacity.
No, and even the seats aren't necessarily that easy, depending on what the model is.
Okay. And easier than an engine or a fuselage.
Probably. But, you know, we've seen tales before of, was it Emirates 787s that were terribly delayed because they didn't have the new business class seats?
Yeah, or, I mean, didn't AA with their 78s have that issue?
I think so, probably, right? Like, the reason I remember the Qatar Airways one is, should I say the Emirates before? I meant Qatar Airways. I meant Qatar, I'm sorry. They flew them all to Qatar to do a delivery in December, right before the new year. So they were contractually delivered. They had to deal with some paperwork and like financial stuff that they had to go all the way to Qatar. And then they turned around and flew them back to Seattle.
I remember that.
To park them until they could get the shit fixed and finished and installed. So, yeah, good times. But anyway, so that's the American order. What else we got on here? Starlink run. I went to Hawaii on Friday for 3 hours.
Unplanned.
Well, I mean, until Thursday afternoon. I bought the ticket at around 5 o'clock Thursday night, Seattle time. Not Seattle, well, Seattle also, but LA time. I was supposed to fly LAX to Boston. I had a United nonstop booked. It was going to be fine. Get home for dinner. Texted my wife to make sure she wasn't going to change the locks when I didn't show up. And then instead flew Long Beach to Honolulu on an A321neo.
Hey, how was that?
That plane had the new Starlink Wi-Fi installed on it.
Nice. How'd it work?
Not shockingly. Incredibly well. As I said to a number of people, I tried to break it and I couldn't. And I usually can find something that doesn't work in one of those systems. So an application, a something somewhere. The closest I could come up with is that when you log in, so the thing about the Starlink is like, it's, you know, wide open, log in, no capture portal, no payment, no nothing. Hawaiian has two different SSIDs, and one is called Starlink on Hawaiian Airlines, and the other is called Movies on Hawaiian Airlines, because they have a streaming movie server on board.
Okay.
And my seatmate, despite an announcement being made overhead, which, you know, if you're not paying attention to, is easy to tune out, and the word Starlink being in there, got confused and picked the Movies one and couldn't figure out why he couldn't stream his movies from the ground.
Yeah, okay.
And then I very nice, you know, awkwardly slash politely leaned over and tapped and changed his Wi-Fi network. And then he's like, what? I'm like, that's the one you want. Trust me. And then he streamed movies for the next 5 hours with no problems. And we got to talking at the end of the flight. He's like, oh, you know, what are you doing in Hawaii? And he's like, I asked him and he's like, yeah, I'm out here. I'm visiting my son. Wife has custody. Ex-wife has custody. He lives out here. So we're going to play some golf for the weekend, whatever, whatever. He's like, cool. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, turning around and going back to the mainland. Which is roughly the response I expected, was the laughter you gave me there and the dumbfounded look on his face. Like, but why? I'm like, I flew to Hawaii so I could be on this plane to use this internet and understand how it's working, et cetera, et cetera. And so we got talking about it at that point. And it was funny, is he was like, I won't fly this airline. I won't fly that airline. The Wi-Fi always sucks. You got to pay $20 for it and this and that. And by the end, he's like, I love that it's free. He's like, I'd pay for it if it worked, which people always say that and they don't pay, but also it kind of doesn't work as well as people want it to when they pay. So
right.
Hard to know which one is really real there. But it was an interesting, very much sort of man of the people conversation of someone who doesn't get neck deep in any of this stuff, but he's flown enough airlines to know that there's different systems on them. It was asking me, like, which, if I fly this airline going home, if you fly Alaska Airlines back to the mainland, he's like, am I going to have Wi-Fi on that one? Because he didn't, you know, not all of them have it.
Right.
Oh, especially over the ocean, like Viasat doesn't work out there now. So Delta doesn't work on the single aisles. So, but yeah, that was a pretty amusing thing. Also, the check-in agent in Long Beach, the kiosk did not work for my ticket because I booked a multi-city Long Beach to Honolulu to Boston. As I handed her my ID, I'm like, yeah, can I get my boarding passes, please? She's like, yep, clickety-clack. Like, and your final destination is, I'm like, Boston. She's like, okay, that's what it says here. I just wanted to make sure because that's a new one for me. You and me both, ma'am. You and me both. So anyway, it was actually quite fine. There were the Hawaiian basically committed to putting a fitted plane on the route that day. And they had to shuffle a couple things around because the conference I was at was the Airline Passenger Experience Association, APEX, has a technical conference every spring. And so a bunch of airline executives were out there, and a couple had asked about maybe trying to, you know, get a test run. So it was me and two airline employees, executives who manage oversee Wi-Fi for their airlines, who are not Hawaiian Airlines.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's, you know, we've talked about Wi-Fi probably not as much as I want to, and probably more than you and Steven want to, but it's interesting to me and nice to see that, especially these days, because so many of the systems are deployed, generally speaking, the people in charge of this stuff really do fly it, and they fly their competitors, and they go out and try to figure out what's good, what's bad, you know, how does it work? You know, one of the people said to me as we were looking at the airplane right outside the boarding door, like, you're looking, trying to see the radome on top, and the commander was like, wow, it's really flat, huh? Because the antenna, I mean, I've got a picture in the story and whatever, but like, it's really flat. Like, the strobe light on top of the plane standing up taller than the antenna now.
Oh, wow.
So then I don't understand all of the details with aerodynamics, and it's a flat surface on top, which actually causes some turbulence in airflow as opposed to a curved surface. And again, I don't understand all the physics, but apparently you want curved, not flat, for some reasons. But low drag, it matters, right? Like, how much extra fuel burn are you bringing around carrying the weight of the thing plus the air disturbance, turbulence situation that it causes on board?
Right.
So it's one of those things, but it was neat to know that there's other executives on, you know, airline executives on board looking at it. And then we all got off the plane in Honolulu and sort of compared notes. We're like, that worked, right? Yep, it worked. So, anyway, it's pretty cool.
I'm sure Ed would disagree with you about United's employees doing that testing.
I think Ed would probably disagree that they do it on their own planes.
Touché. So I will say it's been a lot more reliable lately than it used to be.
So I'm going to channel put on my iPad here. So we're up to 30% now?
I actually can't tell you the last time I had an issue with it.
That's impressive.
And even over water, the coverage has gotten better.
Nice. I know. The overwater stuff is all Panasonic. I know they've been buying additional satellite capacity of late, so it's good to hear that that's going into use.
I mean, I will say, when I did a Cape Town run a couple weeks ago, and BA's Wi-Fi was far, far crappier than United's overwater.
Interesting.
The BA system, I couldn't even load up some, I had a Google document I was trying to load up. I couldn't even load that up. For like 3 hours. I tried and I just gave up.
On the transatlantic or the north-south?
North-south. On a
350-1000. Okay. North-south is interesting. There's sometimes some challenges near the equator and getting the antenna to point, right?
Oh, no. I'm like talking well past the equator, like over Morocco, over the Mediterranean, coming into over Europe.
Well, north. Yeah. Probably not, but one of the things that can happen is, depending on where the antenna is and where the tail is and where the satellite is, the antenna can have to point through the tail. And if you're headed north, the antenna is pointing south because it's got to point to the equator and then up. You shouldn't have been so far north that it had to point through the tail, but that is a thing that happens sometimes. You get like shading.
Man, no, I understand what you mean.
But anyway, but you pointed out that BA is adding in-flight messaging for free for, I assume, for obvious members or executive club members?
You know, I actually didn't get... I saw the headline. I haven't had the chance to read up all about it, but
yeah.
It's an interesting twist.
So, I mean, I would assume it's for executive club members, if only because, other than Starlink services like the Hawaiian one, basically, or JetBlue that just does everybody for free, everyone else doing something free like that ties it to the loyalty program. Air Canada does, United does, Delta does. As an aside, the conference I was at last week, like I said, was about all this stuff. The Delta executive presenting said that some people actually pay because they don't have a SkyMiles account.
Can you not sign up for SkyMiles on the plane?
You can.
And people would rather just pay interest.
Apparently far less. It's like well less than 1%, but some people do in fact pay for it. So that's a bizarre bit.
Interesting.
Yeah. But now, in-flight messaging for free is always nice. My one complaint about that generally is... What qualifies as messaging on which airline is a moving target?
Oh, yeah. That's a game of whack-a-mole.
Right? And, like, if you use Instagram or Twitter/X or or TikTok, any of the social media apps as your direct messaging client, those are almost certainly not going to work. You have to use a messaging-only sort of platform, and then even you have to, like, get lucky that the one you're using is supported.
Right. And with, like, some work sometimes, even though they're not on the supported list.
Yeah.
Like, it just, I can't stay on top of it.
So, still better than nothing. So, there you go. Yeah. I think that's most of what we're going to talk about for in-flight connectivity today. Maybe a little more later. The JetBlue Spirit deal is dead.
It is dead.
The two have five official. Are they actually going to still go through with the appeal? That's the part I wasn't sure about, because the appeal had been filed. And I'm like, American wants to still appeal its NEA deal being killed with JetBlue, but they agreed that given the regulatory landscape, it was probably not going to go through. So JetBlue paid another some million dollars to close out its pending prepayments to Spirit, and basically is out $500 million and did not get an airline in exchange.
Which is like, and maybe you would know this. The article I was reading was they paid like 48 or 60, something like that, $1 million to close this out. But the number is supposed to be closer to 400 billion.
So or they have been paying on a month by month basis.
Okay.
A prepayment. And then I'd have to go back and check the original deal. What I can't remember if that prepayment was to cover the kill fee if it came to that, or if it was separate from the kill fee.
Right.
So, the breakup fee was 400, if I remember correctly. So I can't remember if the prepayment was basically prepaying that, or if it was not.
And I'm surprised the contract wasn't written in such a way that, like, if we cancel because we can't get regulatory approval, there's no payment.
So that was the whole point, though, of the deal, is Spirit basically insisted, knowing that regulatory approval was going to be challenging, they wanted a guarantee that they get paid either way.
I mean, good for them, but like, why take that risk?
Yes, I'm just reading. I'm reading the notes now. The 10 cents per share, this monthly payment they were getting was a ticking fee, was not the part of the breakup fee. So yeah, they JetBlue got a deal on the breakup fee.
Interesting. Okay. I'll need to go to cut something. And maybe that part of the ticking fee was part of the wild card, where they should have said, this isn't worth it. This could drag out for a while.
Well, the contract did have a 2-year out. There's like an 18-month deal, and then a 2-year deal was the outside closure date. And they said, if it's not going to happen by then, we're just not doing it. Yeah. But again, they didn't give them the right to get out of the breakup fee. So fair to negotiate that the breakup fee got reduced, whatever. I think Spirit still did. I mean, JetBlue doesn't have an airline and spent a lot of money. Spirit has a lot of debt and doesn't have a lot of money and has to figure out what its business plan is going to be, because it was sort of treading water for a while there. They'd say they weren't, but by all accounts, they weren't making crazy moves anymore. So,
do they start selling planes?
They've done some sale leaseback deals to raise cash.
I'm saying, do they just start selling planes to get rid of the fleet?
I'd be surprised by that. I mean, part of that is they've got a bunch grounded because of engine issues.
They actually don't have that many. They have 137 320s and only 41 321s.
Yeah, so it's just under 200 planes, and like something like 20% of them are going to be grounded by the end of this year because of engine problems. So there's not much to sell if you want to stay in business.
Yeah, there's only two parked right now.
Yeah, but there's going to be a lot more later in the year, they've said. So not great, but they're now both companies back on their own, and once again, we shall see what unfolds in the future.
Only time will tell.
Yeah. You have plans to go see the Aurora next month? Not Aurora. Why did I write Aurora here?
I don't know. Did you mean the Eclipse?
I meant Eclipse.
I do not. I hear it's getting a little crazy to even try to go anywhere to see the Eclipse.
I would imagine so. So this is a full Eclipse. It's going to run from Texas all the way up through the north end of Vermont and Maine, passing, arcing across the sky. And there's been a lot of people going and working their way to try to see it in different places. At one point, we were going to try to go to upstate New York and catch it there. Turns out, I guess I could just drive 3 hours north to the Canadian border here and try to catch it, which would be easier than driving to upstate New York / southern Canada over there. But it'll be interesting. But both Delta and Southwest Airlines have some eclipse viewing flights that they're running. So Delta, I think, did it's like Austin to Indianapolis or Pittsburgh or something like that, right? They like added a special flight that was basically designed to take off in the middle of the totality and fly north, basically trying to keep up with the sun to maximize time in the middle of this sort of eclipse darkness. And they put it on sale, they sold it out, and then they put out a press release saying that it was on sale, and suddenly everybody went and looked and tried to buy it, but couldn't because it was already sold out. And so they added Death in Flight.
Okay, so I got to ask, and Eclipse is kind of cool and all, but really, is it, do you need to go this far out of your way to see it?
I think, generally speaking, if you're on the ground, you get like a few minutes of totality. And so doing it in the sky, you get an extended period. It's cool. They've done, a couple years ago, there was another one, and other airlines did a similar thing, and it was a big deal. So
I remember as a child, there was an eclipse. I got to go out and see it for a few minutes.
Yeah, pinhole, whatever.
That was good enough. Like, I didn't feel like I needed to see it for hours. Like, I get darkness every night.
Well, it's different darkness, Foz, but okay. You can be a, you know.
I'll be a curmudgeon-y old man right now. Okay. I'm thinking Steven. I'm channeling Steven right now.
Fair enough. Well, then you're going to really be excited when I tell you about Southwest Airlines' deal.
Oh, no.
They've added two flights that are special also for the eclipse and a partnership with Omni Hotels.
Ooh.
Which you can win tickets on the flight plus hotels at each end, one night each, and tickets to and from on Southwest to and from positioning to get to the trip. And the rooms at the Omni Hotels are going to be eclipse themed.
Wait, I have a much more important question. Are they only selling window seats on these flights?
I was about to ask and mention that. That was next on my list. Can you imagine being stuck in like the aisle seat for this? We're like, so I'm just on the flight and I can't fucking see anything.
I'm taking a flight from Austin to Indianapolis. Yay.
Yeah. Awkward to the time that I didn't really need to go, but I guess I can sort of see over that guy who's leaning and blocking the window the whole time. Great.
It looks dark at the window.
I don't know. The theme hotel rooms thing, I think it's pretty funny. Like, my comment there is like, oh, the lights in the bathroom actually turn off, so it's dark like an eclipse. But anyway.
We give you little glow sticks when you check in. Yeah. The lights are all off in the hotel. You need to use these, please.
Awkward. What else we got here? Qantas new A220s finally in service.
That's exciting.
Yeah. First two are running. I think we maybe talked a little bit about that last week too. Running routes out of Melbourne. So
are they replacing the 717s?
Yep. So oh, cool. Yeah, as the 220s come in, the 717s go away. It's a cycle over the next few years.
Are the 717s just rolling over to Delta like all the 717s do?
I do not know what their future holds, but Hawaii's getting rid of theirs too. So eventually. Who can run in the longest? We'll see.
What is Hawaii replacing theirs with?
They actually haven't announced the order yet, but they need to. I don't think they have. Anyway.
It'll probably be Max 8s because they can get them super cheap.
At one point, they were talking about that, I think, just shrinking frequencies, but doing that. But I think that would be crazy for their business model and plan. But then again, if Alaska Airlines takes over, who knows?
Well, it wouldn't be that crazy if they can do rotations to the mainland with it. They could get better fleet utilization.
Yes, and potentially fewer cycles on them for, you know, maintenance reasons. But one of the reasons Hawaii is so well loved is it's a bus between the islands. It's commuter service.
Yeah, but you can still do that. But
Yeah, but you can. It's harder. It's
the frequencies inter island have dropped so much. I was looking at this a week ago.
Yeah,
like it is from what it used to be to what it is now. The frequencies have dropped drastically. Like, some routes are only two or three times a day.
That's fair. I mean, you know, you make me want to go look a couple up, but
yeah, like, I was looking at Maui to Hilo and to Kona. Okay. And Hilo, I think, is like three times a day, and Kona is maybe five times a day.
Yeah, so Hawaiian Airlines operating Maui to Ito and Koa, and we're going to compare shooting quarters, because sure, why not? Q1 2024 to Q1 2014. How's that?
Sure.
And we're going to show the destinations. I always do these steering queries wrong the first time. In Q1 2014, Hawaiian operated from Maui to Hilo 180 flights, and in Q1 of this year, it's 86, so roughly double daily down to single daily. Kona went from triple daily to double daily. Oh, no, sorry, other way around. Kona's actually increased. Kona was also double daily and has increased to three times daily. So win some, lose some.
Okay. But it's still not a lot when you're only looking at two or three a day.
Yeah. Honolulu to those two routes are both down slightly as well. But again, you know, less than 10% change. So
I mean, I remember at one point Honolulu and Maui would be like every 15 minutes.
Yeah. That's an interesting one to check. Well, as long as we're here. Honolulu to Maui is down, call it 15% in seats, and at frequencies 2,400 to 1,900.
Plausible.
Yeah. So
yes, right.
Some of the inter-island stuff is down.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of that is driven by Southwest entering the market.
Yes, very much so.
Which makes sense. But that's why I think Hawaiian could actually start rotating some of these planes to the mainland and use larger planes.
Yeah.
Really? Just for fleet efficiencies.
I'm in. Let's do it.
Okay.
Last quick story to throw at it in this episode here. Going back to Melbourne, which is where we were with the A220s. Turkish first flight to Melbourne finally happened.
That's exciting.
It is. They're going to launch Sydney later in the year, apparently, and have said that at least for now, those two will be the only markets they operate, pending getting planes that can actually do it nonstop, it sounds like.
They're not running to Brisbane like everybody else?
No. No. Only the big three U.S. carriers are doing that to get ready for the 2032 Olympics, apparently.
Or the subsidies. Take the subsidies while they count.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great for Turkish.
Yeah.
I wondered, could they do Perth nonstop?
It's a fair question.
They have 789s, and
yeah,
Qantas can do it from Rome and
London. That's, I mean, yes. Yeah. So, yes, if Qantas can get to Rome and London, then certainly Istanbul should be in range. But yeah, I mean, because of the shape of the Earth and the shape of Australia, 1,800 miles further to get to Sydney than Perth from Istanbul. 7,500 miles to 9,300.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Big country.
And it's just, yeah. Ours, coast to coast.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about on this episode before you move over to the bonus topic?
No, I think I'm actually pretty good.
Alrighty. Well, as always, listeners, thanks for sticking with us and listening to me and Foz ramble on, as it were. Quick shout out to Riley W. and Andrew R., a couple of our new Patreon supporters. Thank you for supporting the show and subscribing there. You will, as all of our supporters get, access to some bonus topics, another 20 or 30 minutes of additional rambling for people who just can't have enough of our idiocy. This week, we're talking a little bit more about the Aeromexico Delta antitrust stuff, Boeing's mess, another trip report I took last week with New Pacific, award flights to Malaga, and some Lufthansa things, among other bits. So stick around for that if you're a Patreon supporter. If not, feel free to mash that button that gets you over to sign up, or just, like and subscribe, right? That's a thing people say these days still, maybe.
Yes.
Anyway, alrighty. We're done here. Happy travels.
Take care.